We've been talking about the life that we find in Christ, the life that is ours in Christ. And I think there's so much that I don't understand about this reality, this inheritance, this gift of love that Jesus has offered. And the thing that's been so arresting for me as I walked my way through this book has just been how often my assumptions about what the life is that I'm receiving from God has been so far below what was offered, right? My assumptions, my expectations, my willingness to believe has been so far below what was being offered. And Jesus and John, through John here, God is expressing the significance of what this life looks like. If you fully embrace, if you drown, are baptized into Christ, if you become so immersed in the reality of the life that you have in God, there is so much power that is accessible to you. There is so much life and truth and hope, and all of the identity questions come into sharp, you know, relief. You recognize what's true and what's not. It is such a great, good thing that we have. And so often we miss that because of the fact that it really doesn't meet expectations. And I think that's one of the things that sort of centered into my mind as I was thinking about this, sort of the introductory portion of the letter that John wrote, or the account that he wrote here. So the thing that I think I want to look at this morning, there's a few things I want to touch on. First off, let's make sure that we remember where, sort of contextually, what we've been seeing prior to this point. So last week we were talking about especially this nature of discipleship, right? You see in the last part of chapter 1 how disciples are being birthed, right? And we talk about this nature of discipleship, the way that it looks to be a disciple. We talked about the fact that Christ asks every follower more or less the same question. Why? What are you seeking? More or less, that's the question, really, that every person who comes to Christ and says, I want to believe in Jesus, what? What do you want to believe about Jesus? What are you actually seeking, right? That question confronts the believer, that confronts every heart, every day. What are you seeking? Why are you believing? What are you looking for out of your relationship with Christ? What is the expectation that you have that will be because of this relationship? The answer to that question is the truest test of your pursuit of Jesus. And this has been something that's been really important for me. As I've been working through my own understanding of what it means to be a disciple of Christ, I've realized that I have to be as honest as I can be with myself. What am I seeking? What do I think I get out of being a believer? What is my expectation from this experience? What do I want from Jesus? And I am so amazed how often, if I think long enough, if I'm quiet enough, to actually hear myself and to listen to the answers that my heart gives to the fact of what I'm seeking for Jesus, I find idols almost every time. Almost every time I encounter things that are less than what it could be, and so much more is available, or I'm seeking something, you know, seeking through Christ into something. I'm looking for something on the other side. If I believe in Jesus, then I can have, and there's this other piece. But this question, what are you seeking, was pivotal. Jesus wanted to know to these men who had been following John the Baptist, what do you want? What are you here for? What do you expect to get, right? And that's an interesting, very important question of every disciple. We also looked at the idea that following Jesus involves a whole lot of tests that require us to come and see what is actually true about him. You can't be a true disciple if you're unwilling to actually check out the claims that he makes. And this is important, right? Jesus says, come and see, right? It's not so much that he says, okay, let me lay out my agenda for you. Let me tell you exactly every piece. Now, he gives you hints, certainly. You are called Cephas, but I'm going to call you Peter. There is so much in that God is doing, that Jesus is doing for Peter. He's sort of shaping a reality for him that Peter didn't even realize at the time. I mean, can you imagine if you're Peter and you're like, why are we changing my name again? I don't really understand the deal here. Like, why are we doing this thing where hi, I'm Mike. Okay, I'm going to call you Steve. Like, if that was me, people would get it. They'd be like, yeah, you just can't remember names well. That's probably what this is. But in Jesus' case, there's obviously something else going on here. Why are you changing my name? And Jesus says, come and see, right? Come and see. Stay with me. You will discover that you have so much that's coming to you that I would overwhelm you if I even told you a half of it. And so Jesus says, just come. Just test and see what's true. And we talked about the fact that the point of this is really the test itself. Come test and see if God is who he claims to be. Guys, we are so afraid of testing God. We are terrified of it, and we're partly afraid of that because we've got this mistaken notion that somehow is anti-biblical or anti-scriptural, right? The idea of do not test God, right? And we have that whole argument between the accuser and Jesus himself, and he says, it is written, do not test the Lord your God, right? And so, but we've talked about what that is, right? We've talked about what specifically it means to believe God. There's a difference. There's an entire difference between, is it really that, or is it really that? Right? There's a difference between the questions that we're asking. A true, honest pursuit of Jesus is willing to say, I will test whatever you're claiming to be so. I will assume that it's true. I will believe in you. Right? I will believe actually in you. And that means that I will assume that what you're telling me is true. And I will test what you're telling me to prove it's true. And if I discover that it wasn't what I thought it was, then I will discover more of what is true. We are told to test God. We are told and encouraged to consider and to taste the fact that He is good and that He is going to accomplish great good for His glory and for us. And this is something that a true disciple does. They test this out. You see this with Nathanael, especially last week when Nathanael was told, hey, I think we found him. I think we found Messiah. Come, check it out. And he goes and he asks the right questions and he tests that. And then he says, I believe this is true. And then he continues to grow and continues to test and continues to expand in his understanding of that truth. We also last week looked at the idea that bringing others to Jesus doesn't require a perfect sales pitch, nor does it require full understanding. It's simply bringing people we know to Him to find answers. And it's often our own understanding that is changed in that process. That's the thing that I think is beautiful about this process of discipleship, is that, again, you have Andrew who goes and says, hey, come, I think we found him. I think we found Messiah. And Nathanael says, Messiah? How could Messiah come from Nazareth? Really? I doubt that. And he comes and he encounters something that's true. And what was Andrew's assumptions about Jesus? He was Jesus of Nazareth, right? Son of Joseph, right? Two things that were sort of true, but not altogether true. And Nathanael gets to expand his understanding. So he's proclaiming what he knows or what he assumes to be true and says, let's go together and let's test this thing. Let's answer the questions. Let's discover what's true. And he also, in the process, gets to know more of who God is. Because he gets to see something pretty significant as Jesus describes to Nathanael, I was part of this process with you before. I saw you under that tree when you were praying. I know who you are. You're going to see greater things than you could possibly imagine. The heavens opened and angels ascending and descending. You will encounter things in your pursuit of me that will unravel your expectations or your assumptions about who I am. And so this was sort of this discipleship model that we saw. And it was a very simple, straightforward thing. While you're in the way, right? This is what we were talking about. Just while you're living life, encountering things that are true about God and taking others who may not know that same thing and say, isn't this amazing? We overcomplicate this way too much. We spend so much energy and effort trying to systemize something that isn't a system. It's a relationship. Your relationship with Christ is going to change you. And admittedly, it's good to understand how it works, and it's okay to give definition to that. And it's not inappropriate to say, to sort of noodle through and consider how they all connect, but ultimately the change that's going to occur in you is going to come through exposure to just being with Jesus, and that's going to bring others into the same place. So the next section that we're going to look at here is in the middle of chapter 1, right? The middle portion. We're going to start in verse number 19 of John chapter 1. 19. So here we have sort of, again, this introductory argument that John is making. What was John's intention? What was the theme or purpose behind his writing? What is he trying to get us to believe or understand in this particular book? Who Christ is. Who is that? Who is Christ? Who Christ is? Yeah. Savior, Messiah, our example. The Christ, God in the flesh, divine, right? Who is Christ? Let me tell you. Let me introduce you. See, John is really doing the same thing that we're talking about now as we talk about this discipling process. He says, let me show you. Let me write something to you so that you may believe that He is Christ and that believing you may find life in His name. I want you to get this. I want you to see the glory of Christ, and so I want to introduce you to this idea. And so he spends his time doing this, and here we're looking at one particular testimony that he chooses to draw on. So again, I find it fascinating how often we circle around the idea of John the Baptist and we sort of get different perspectives of him, but I have this sneaking suspicion that there was a whole lot more going on with John the Baptist than even we either know or recognize or are told. There has to be, because the significance of John the Baptist, I mean, how much he's often in Matthew, he's described, there's never been a man yet like John the Baptist. Think of that statement for a moment. There has never been a man yet like John the Baptist. And again, I don't know that there's a ton of people in their minds when they start thinking of sort of like biblical characters and you have the flannel graphed up and everybody knows You know, you got Abraham, and you got Jacob, and Joseph, and David, and Solomon, and Elijah, and Elisha. And, I mean, you got Isaiah. You got some pretty incredible characters, right? You got some incredible characters, and Jesus says there has never been a man that has walked the face of the world like this guy. You think, whoa. Imagine the maker of heaven and earth making that statement, right? The creator, there has never been one like this. This is John the Baptist. And so he, again, that's why I'm convinced that there's got to be stuff with him in particular that we either just read past without recognizing the significance of, or we're just not even told, right? So what do we know about John the Baptist? Let's get some ideas here. Before we read this section here, let's kind of get some context here. Because again, what we have in John, the book of John, it's not part of the synoptics, right? We talk about the synoptic gospels being Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right? And those ones are pretty similar, more or less. I'm in my teaching mode now because we're doing New Testament survey. You're not in my teaching. Are you in NT survey? No, OT survey. Okay, that's fine. But we're thinking about the synoptic gospels. So you've got these stories that are pretty well lined up, but John goes a whole different route, right? He kind of takes it in a different direction because he has a different purpose behind his writing. So a lot of the stuff that we know about, especially John the Baptist, really comes from Matthew and from Luke and a little from Mark as well, right? But there are some pretty interesting things that we do know. So what do you know about John the Baptist? Someone's like, hey, you go to a Baptist church. Who's John the Baptist, right? Which I think is hilarious. That is the funniest question I've had yet. Oh, you're a Baptist? So who was John the Baptist? And they're assuming that, like, Baptist means that you're sort of an adherent of John the Baptist. That's an interesting question. But who is he? John the Baptist. He was the son of a priest, so he's a PK. That's good. Important to know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was the son of a priest. Right? You forget that. Which, by the way, kind of informs a little bit of the opinion, because it actually seems like there was a measure of respect that existed between the Sanhedrin, the Levites, and John. I mean, it wasn't true respect, but there was at least more respect than what you got from Jesus. I mean, there seems to be more recognition of John's sort of authority, and you wonder, why is that? I mean, even Herod, right? When Herod was, well, I'm getting ahead of the story. Yeah, he was a PK. I'll stop before I give away other things. Yes, so he was the son of a priest. What else? Sorry, what? Whose cousin? Jesus' cousin! This is Jesus' cousin. Think of that for a moment, right? Like, there's actually like a family relationship that exists here, which, that's gotta be weird. You know, that's gotta be an interesting thing. Be like, hey, this is my cousin. Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. So the relationship between Elizabeth and Mary, it's pretty clear. We understand that they considered themselves, there seems to be a relationship that existed in that context. So the question could be asked in Jesus' case, you know, which line are you directing it from? Okay, but what about, so maybe I'm thinking the wrong direction then, with Zechariah and with, and you're, so you're saying with Zechariah and Elizabeth, they may not have intermarried. I don't know the answer to that one. An interesting question. Well, and even there's another question that arises from this one as well that came to my mind. So we have this assumption about the way the Levites worked and sort of the relationship that existed there. How is he even having kids in the first place? Isn't that something that they sometimes didn't do, sometimes did do? There were arguments that people made about celibacy, which I don't think is true. Well, we know it's not true, especially in this instance, but with the Catholic Church, there's questions about how that all works. But yeah, there are a lot of questions about that. That's an interesting one. I'm not sure. My assumption would probably be that it connects somewhere between Zechariah and Elizabeth. That's a good question. So you've got at least a recognized, culturally recognized connection, right? Their family. Interesting. What else? What else do we know about John the Baptist? Yeah. A little bit crazy. Rude. Okay. He ate bugs, he wore camel hair, he was from the wilderness. Okay. All of those things being true, yeah. So we think of him as sort of this, and in fact he's sort of been caricatured to a measure, sort of this rough and tumble, wore camel hair and had this leather belt. They went to the trouble of describing, like, he had a leather belt. Like, okay, fair enough. And, you know, and then he ate locusts and wild honey, and certainly was in a region, a pretty inhospitable region of the area there. Absolutely. So we assume that to sort of mean that he was crazy. At the very least, he was sort of on the outskirts of society, for sure. Whether or not he himself kind of came off as a little cuckoo, I don't know. I mean, in my head, he does too, Tiffany. I'm right there with you. Like, I see him very, very outlandish. But at the same time, we're not told for sure. But certainly, he would be considered by most people to be a little bit out of the norm. A little weird. What he was doing in particular seemed a little different. Good. What else do we know about him? Yeah, we're going to talk about that especially today. The humility that he expresses. Good. So his message in particular we'll discuss. He was called and commissioned to that message. I like how he shows up on the scene. Do you notice how John the Baptist shows up on the scene? Say what? It's abruptly. And suddenly he appeared in the wilderness proclaiming. Right? So there doesn't appear to be this whole ramp into his ministry. It feels like just one day, called and commissioned by God, he began to proclaim something that was true. Just out of the blue. And it was arresting. The message that he was proclaiming was arresting. It caught people's attention. Crowds were going to this place, which was, again, kind of unexpected, that he would be sort of centering his ministry in the wilderness areas, and they were going to hear from him. And he was not careful about how he communicated the message either. It wasn't like he was sort of doing this sort of slick presentation. He was very abrupt in the way that he confronted things that he encountered. They asked all kinds of questions of him. They're like, okay, what are we supposed to do about taxes? How should we handle these things? And he answers very, very straightforward. He calls the Jewish establishment snakes, right? Snakes. So he's not being careful in the way that he's communicating this. He is a very interesting person. And people are confused about what his purpose or what his objective would be in that. And they make some assumptions that we're going to look at in just a minute, but certainly they're very arrested by him as a person. And that reputation, we talked about this a little bit last week, but that reputation doesn't just stop once he introduces Jesus and he sort of disappears from the scene and then eventually is killed. That reputation continues, right? There are perpetually people that say, I came to Jesus through John the Baptist. I have followed the principles and the baptism of John. I'm invested in John the Baptist, and whether it's Apollos or whether it's even in some of Jesus' disciples, we know of at least two of them, right? That were disciples of John that we encountered last week that started following Jesus. Andrew, and most likely the John the Apostle who's writing this letter. Because he doesn't name himself, so it's a kind of a clue to the fact that it's probably him who was also an apostle of John the Baptist, a disciple of John the Baptist who then becomes disciples of Jesus. So he has a very compelling sort of effective, if you want to say, ministry of what he was doing. And what particularly was he doing? So he's called John the Baptist. What's that? He's dunking people. He's baptizing, right? Which we think of and we're like, okay, so he was out sort of in this river and he was baptizing. We know he certainly baptizes as Jesus, and we'll look at that here in a minute. But he's baptizing. And again, think of this, because we look at this and we're like, well, that would probably be really unusual for folks. Not actually. This was a very common practice. But the way he was doing it was not common. So the idea of baptism existed before, you know, this idea of John baptizing. But most often how it was sort of accomplished was that you would have sort of a Gentile proselyte, somebody who wants to become Jewish, and they would baptize themselves. Most often the recorded history is that they would baptize themselves. They would get into a river and they would say, I'm cleansing myself of my Gentile nature, and I'm becoming sort of aligning with Judaism. And so there was a familiar sort of process, and it would happen in other places as well. Perhaps maybe it wasn't even just Judaism. A number of other religious traditions included this idea of sort of baptizing yourself into the ideas or the teachings of that particular person. And so when you are baptized into that person, you basically bring yourself into the water and you say, I'm covering myself in alignment with a sort of the public proclamation of my adherence to that particular teacher's understanding. So John is baptizing people. And it seems that he was doing this from a position of authority where he has the right to baptize. And that is one of the questions that we'll look at. Okay, so now let's read through this portion, sort of thinking through who John is and what he was doing. Let's read where we start here in John chapter 1, verse 19. And this is the testimony of John. Okay, stop. I said I would read it, but we got to talk about it. Testimony, why? Why does John the Apostle, the writer here, want to talk about the testimony of John? Why does he include that particular language? What's he writing this for? It's a witness to who Christ is. This is the testimony to the truth of who Christ is. This is, I'm calling my first witness. I am writing this that you may believe that he is God. And that by believing you might find life. Let me call my first witness. His name is John the Baptist. All right? This is the testimony of John. He is testifying to what is true about Jesus. When the Jews sent the priests and the Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who are you? So he gives context. He says, this is how John expressed the truth of Jesus when he was confronted with the question who he was. Now notice, and John does this often, most of the time, in fact, in his letter. The Jews is not like meant to be like in terms of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a national reference. This is specifically, almost exclusively used as the leaders, the Sanhedrin, the religious establishment. They send Levites and priests from Jerusalem to ask. Now notice, they don't go themselves. They send sort of this cohort out to go figure that out. And they seem to be curious about what was happening, and so they send a group of representatives, of officials, if you want to call it, out to hear what John was saying and to ask him, who are you? And he confessed and did not deny, but confessed, I am not the Christ. Now the language there is beautiful. He confessed, and we don't think it's beautiful. We read it and think that's weird. He confessed and did not deny, but confessed. Why does it translate it like that? Doesn't that seem strange to you? When you come across stuff like that as you're reading and you come to these words and you're like, he confessed. And did not deny, but he confessed. What you're doing is you're encountering the best English rendering of a word that meant he was livid. He was emphatic. It's a double emphasis. He confessed doubly. Did not deny, but confessed with sort of this almost an angry expression. I am not the Christ. Now here's the thing. They said, who are you, right? And he understands from that question the implication. Who are you? If you think I am the Christ, you are gravely mistaken. And that angers me. It frustrates me to even consider, to even have the assumption that you would think that I am the Christ. I am not the Christ. I'll tell you this right now. That piece right there has been burned into my brain over the last 7 years that I've been ministering to. This has been something that has settled into my heart at a depth that I can't even really describe to a measure, because I have been so frustrated in my pursuit of Christ. And in particular, in my pursuit of Christ through men that I trusted to disciple me. And the problem and the reason why this mattered so much is I was reading a book once, and the book encouraged this to be the fundamental heart of your belief as a minister of the gospel. I am not the Christ. And that idea is so important. That confession, that anxious, reiterated, double emphasis, I am not the Christ, is one of the places where we get screwed up most often in Christendom. We think we have, we assume that we are the Christ, and the way that we present it, we say we get the ones that get to tell you how you do Christianity. We are the ones who are converting you to our ideas and systems rather than saying, I am not here to be the one you worship. I am not here to be the one that you follow. I am not here to be the one that you set up. I am not the Christ. And if you get nothing else from any type of ministry experience through me, please know I am not the Christ. But that's only half the story, right? That's only half the piece, because he starts with, I am not the Christ. And then he comes later and says, in verse 23, I am the voice, right? So it's not so much that it's saying I'm not. He starts by saying emphatically, I am not what you think I am, but I do have a role. And my role is to point you to what you're really looking for. So let's look at that. And they asked him, what then? Are you Elijah? Now these questions we look at and we sort of chuckle over, like, oh, ha, 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 what a silly question. Is this a silly question for them to be asking? Are you Elijah? Hello, Elijah was from a long, 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 long time ago. Why would they ask the question in the first place? Any clues? Anybody know? Why would they think or even consider asking, are you Elijah? Are they just going through names in a baby book? Like, are you John? Are you Jacob? Are you Jeff? Why was Elijah this question? Because of a prophecy. There was a prophecy that they had been deeply invested in Malachi in particular. The last prophecy from the last prophet that they had told them to anticipate that there would be, that Elijah would come back and he would be a forerunner for Messiah, right? So they're thinking, are you Elijah? And why in particular was Elijah? Well, frankly, Elijah had a very unique end, right? What was the end of Elijah? Sorry, what? He just left, right? He was there and then he got a hitched a ride home, right? So Elijah has some significance. And not only in the sense of his death, the way that he went to be with God, but also prophetically he has significance. He is a precursor. He is a preparer. He is a path maker for Messiah. And so there's prophecy all the way into Revelation even that describes the fact that Elijah is going to be the one who prepares the path for the final conquering of Christ. Elijah, are you Elijah? They're asking a very reasonable question. Are you Elijah? And he says, I am not. Now here's another problem. Because did you know that in Matthew, Jesus says he was Elijah? Jesus says he was Elijah. So now we really got a problem because he's disagreeing with Jesus himself. Oh boy, John says, I'm not Elijah. Jesus says he is Elijah. What do we do here? How do you receive something where someone says, I am not Elijah, and then Jesus says, but you are Elijah? Well, there's multiple pieces to it, right? How? Let's start with what you assume. Let's hear what you know, because I think I have an idea, but I want to hear yours. What's the connection between John the Baptist and Elijah? Hi. Sorry. Okay. And by type you mean like a representation? Okay. Similar role. Okay. Any other ideas? Okay, so we all agree with Mindy. That's good. So the idea of Elijah in particular and the concept of him being Elijah, what was the promise that was made to Zechariah by the angel? Do you recall? Your son will be born and you will call him John. And he will have the spirit of Elijah. Right? He will have the spirit of Elijah. He will be a type, certainly. There's a representation that he sort of pictures, and he even points to that in the passage from Isaiah that he quotes for himself. But he is also in line with and in union with Elijah in the expression of what was true here. He is part of the process of God introducing Jesus into the picture. And there is a power that is proclaimed in that. There is an astounding reality that stems from this proclamation. And so what he's answering when he says, I am not Elijah in the way that you're assuming, right? I am not Elijah in the way that you were assuming. I am not the one you think you're looking for. There is something deep. There is something mysterious about the connection, especially between Elijah and John the Baptist, and even into the future as we encounter it later in other prophecies, where this proclaimer comes and says, make straight the path. But in this instance, they're saying, are you Elijah like we expect you to be? He says, no, I'm not that. Are you the prophet? Now notice he uses the prophet. So what was the question here? It's another prophetic question. There will be a prophet, the prophet that will come. And in fact, we know according to Acts, or it's Acts or Peter, I think, where it said that, you know, he was in fact that prophet. But John wasn't, but Jesus was that prophet, right? He was the prophet. But in this instance, they're saying, are you the one who is coming, was foretold us, the prophet that we are anticipating? And he answers, no. And so they said to him, who are you? We need to give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself? So, you know, you can almost imagine. And again, in my mind, I find this occurs often, especially in relationship to Jesus as he's introducing himself. People come to Jesus so frequently, especially from the Jews, those that were aligned with the Jewish or with the religious establishment and those that had assumptions about Jesus. And they would come and they would ask these questions, and he would answer with a lot of, no, not that. No, not that. No, not that. And you finally get to this place where you're like, well, then what? And that, to me, is actually another good process of discipleship. Right? Where we think, we make these assumptions. Are you this? No, you're not that. Are you this? No, you're not that. Are you this? No, you're not that. Then who are you? Good question. Now let's answer who I actually am. And he proclaims the reality of his purpose. Who are you? We have to give an answer. You know, I have my query form here, my census form. I got to give an answer. I was sent all the way out here into the desert, 23 to 30 miles out here. Figure out who you are. You got to give me an answer, because otherwise the bosses are going to be mad. Who are you? Who do you claim yourself to be? What do you say about yourself? What authority, what rights do you have? Why are you doing what you're doing? And he said, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said. Now this would have been arresting. This would have been remarkable to the hearers, to all the people who had been deeply steeped in the teaching of Isaiah. You go to Isaiah and Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3. A voice cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert the highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain shall and hill be made low, and the uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. The responsibility that John the Baptist claimed for himself, the job that he said was his call and his commission and his authority and right, was this. And this is amazing. So what is this? What is this job that he is claiming for himself? I am the voice in the wilderness making straight the path to God. I am walking through the spaces that are around that distract from the point of Jesus, and I am drawing a path, a line straight to him. My job is to proclaim Jesus. My task is to be the voice that calls out the things that are standing in the way of belief, so that there's a clear space to know and love God. That is the role of the proclaimer, of the evangelist, of the minister of Jesus, of each person here, is to proclaim the way to get to hope and to truth, a voice. I am a voice crying in the wilderness. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. And the uneven ground shall become level, and the roughest places a plain. The expression that Isaiah is making here is a radical transformation of the topography. Right? This is not a small undertaking that's being described here. The illustration that's drawn for us is one who takes massive, you know, monumental expressions and changes them fundamentally, right? And that is the work of the proclamation of the gospel, is to take those mountains and valleys that stand in the way of smooth sailing into the glory of Christ. And all flesh will see it together, right? For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. There was more to it there. I apologize. I didn't click all the way through. This is what John claims for himself. Now they had been sent from the Pharisees. Now notice that piece right there. Again, this is interesting to me, because you have these priests and these Levites who go to John to say, who are you? What's the deal? Why are you doing what you're doing? And they specify the fact that they had come from the Pharisees. Now, we know that you had the Pharisee party and the Sadducean party, right? And both of those particular groups of individuals and religious leadership had sort of different flavor. The Sadducees were sort of, they're often referred to as sort of more of a liberal perspective. They didn't really believe in miracles. They didn't really believe in you know, special things. They didn't really care too much about, like, they didn't take a literal interpretation of even the Old Testament. Not necessarily. I mean, they kind of took it more poetically in general. But they actually, especially during this period of time, they had sort of the ruling right. So we imagine in our current culture how you've got sort of like a two-party system, and for a period of time, one group is a little bit more influential, and the other group's there, but they dial down the influence, and they're sort of there at check and balance, and then after a while it rebalances, and it kind of goes back and forth between the two. The Sadducees had the chief priests. They had, actually, for like the last four generations, they had been the responsible ones for sort of the temple worship specifically. But the Pharisees had their own voice, and they certainly had a lot of questions related to sort of the spiritual, the more rigid interpretation of Scripture and the spiritual significance of what Scripture was speaking. So they're the ones that ask, then why are you baptizing if you are neither the Christ nor Elijah nor the prophet? So they're asking sort of this theological question. They're like, wait a minute. If you're not those people, if you're not who you say you are, right? If you're not Christ or Elijah or the prophet, what right do you have to baptize? That doesn't seem okay. It doesn't seem like that would be in line with what's expected. I mean, we would get it if another was doing it, but you're none of those. And John answered them, I baptize with water, but among you stands one who you do not know. Even he who comes after me, the strap of whose sandal I am not worthy to untie. Do you these things took place in Bethany across the Jordan where John was baptized. So John makes the answer, right? He gives the answer. He says that the reality of who I am and the significance of who I am and the reason why I have the right to baptize is because of the authority that's been given to me by another. I baptize with water. But there is one who is already here, right? He's announcing. He's in the land. He's here. Who I'm not even worthy to untie the strap. And I know most of us know this, but just in case you don't, this idea of the worthiness to untie his sandals is sort of him, again, that goes to that humility thing with John. The lowest servant, there's a pecking order always, right? In every system, there's always a pecking order. And the lowest servant's job was the one who would, when you had a visitor come in, he would be responsible for sort of undoing the shoes and washing the feet, right? And that was the lowest servant's job. And John says, I'm not even at that level with this guy. Like, I don't even have the right to do the entry-level work for him. He is so far beyond and above who I'm claiming. And it's interesting because this is in connection to the question of authority, right? They're asking appeal to authority. And he says, my authority has been given to me. And by the way, my authority that I have the right to do what I'm doing with isn't even enough authority to untie the dude's sandals. You think you have authority to question my authority? I'm down here, so where does that put you? I mean, it's astounding what his proclamation, his appeal to authority, was completely missing the question, right? I do not even have the authority. I do not have the privilege of even untying a sandal. And they give this sort of description of where he was particularly. Now, here's another thing that's interesting about this account. It's one of the few places where you have a back-to-back, almost like consecutive days. I mean, there are other places where you encounter this, but here specifically, it's very important to understand that sequentially, these are day to day to day. There's a 3-day period of time here that seems to be indicated. And the significance of that, I think, is partly the idea that this is sort of the inauguration of Jesus' ministry. You see that also in another place when you encounter him during the Passion. You know, the next day is sort of a 6-day period that you encounter. But here specifically, you're talking about sort of this day to day to day thing, and they're describing where he is. Now, where's Jesus during this period of time? And the reason I ask that question is because the next day he saw Jesus coming towards him. So where was Jesus before that? Say what? The wilderness. Very good, right? Jesus was being tempted, coming back from his time in the wilderness, being tempted, right? And so he is coming out of that space and walking right up to John. Now, John, you've got to think that, again, Jesus coming out of the temptation of the wilderness, out of that point where he was tempted and the authority of his ministry was challenged. And then he steps into the inauguration from John. It's got to be an amazing thing. The next day he saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man who ranks before me because he was before me." John proclaims the Lamb of God. This is the one I was talking about. Now, even that proclamation should be arresting. Because what are you anticipating? If you're a Jew, what are you anticipating from your Messiah? King, ruler, strong one, on a white steed. And instead, John says, here comes the Lamb. What? The Lamb? I don't want a Lamb. I don't want a Lamb, right? That's not the thing I'm looking for. It's good. He's reading it too. James Earl Jones is over there. James, you got it. You still got it, brother. So the Lamb is coming. You're all right. So this Lamb is being introduced. And again, it caused my mind. My mind was arrested by this idea, especially because he's the one that takes away the sins of the world. And you imagine in your mind sort of this picture of a Lamb. And you don't anticipate that this Lamb is really the strongest way of expressing this this leadership. We had a tragedy in our house this week. Dandelion, for those of you that weren't aware, Dandelion the rabbit is no longer with us. All right, and it's a very sad reality that we all have to face. Unfortunately, she was loved a little too much by the dog. So our rabbit, you know, is now in the loving embrace of the backyard. But the thing that was interesting, and I'm not trying to be crude about this, and I do sincerely, I know we have a new rabbit named Ginger. That was quick, but Ginger's in the family now. But one of the things that I have to be honest with you is that, you know, when Mindy calls me and says, you need to get home, like, there was an accident, and you see this rabbit, and it's dead, and it is not an imposing thing, right? It's not like this, like, glorious thing. It died sort of, and I'm not going to get too graphic, but it died in a way that was like, it was in humility, basically. This rabbit died. And I think of rabbits, and I think of ducks, and I think of lambs, and I don't think of something glorious and monumental and powerful beyond all measure. There's a humility. Behold the Lamb of God who will take the sin of the world on himself. He will die in humility. And he is the one that I told you was before me. Now the question before me, that's an interesting one as well. He was at least 6 months older, right, theoretically, than Jesus. So Jesus was born after him. He came after me, but he is before me in every way. This is almost a proclamation. In fact, I would argue it is, in fact, a proclamation, although maybe not fully understood, of the eternal nature of Jesus himself. He was before, and he is part of the expression of the glory of God, and he is here now. I myself did not know him, but for this purpose I came baptizing with water, that he might be revealed to Israel. All right. Now it's interesting. He says, I myself did not know him, but for this purpose I came baptizing. I didn't know him. It's interesting, John's expression there. And this, to me, sort of highlights the nature of this ministry. We talked earlier about how John just suddenly appears on the scene and begins to proclaim, make straight the paths of God. And you've got to think that his father, Zechariah, mentions to him at least a few different times, hey, just so you know, Mary, she had a son, right? And we know that he's Messiah. So there's a sense in which he's like, he knew it, but there is something unique that's happening here. And how does he bear witness to that? He bore witness, I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and it remained on him. How did I know this was him? Because I saw the Spirit of God on him, and I recognized him as one. We have a tendency to sort of visualize this picture of the Spirit of God sort of descending as a dove, like an actual dove, right? Like we think of this dove sort of sitting on people's heads in those pictures. But it says like a dove, right? This is a description of something that he encountered, he saw. Not with normal eyes, but with other eyes. This is the one on whom the Spirit of God rests, right? And he recognizes that this is, in fact, the one that I've been waiting for. I myself did not know him, but he who sent me to baptize with water said to me, he on whom you see the Spirit descend and remain, this is he who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. And I have seen and bore witness that this is the Son of God. He says, I have the authority to baptize. He who sent me, right? That's a commission and a call. And we're going to touch on that in just a few minutes and talk about the point of this call. But he says, I will know the one that is in fact Messiah when I encounter the Spirit of God descending on him. So the thing that I want to point to, just a couple things that I want to make sure we're clear on here. As we encounter this picture, as we see John the Baptist, I want you to identify just a few pieces. First off, recognize, we've identified it a few times, but the humility, the specific intention of John, and it's kind of what Matt started with, right? John was here for a reason, and he had an identity, and he had a purpose, and he knew, by the Spirit of God, he knew what his job was. My job is to make straight the path. And people were coming to him, asking him questions about taxes, and about baptism, and about all this other stuff. And his point was, I resonate, I do what I'm told. I do what I'm supposed to do. I am making straight the path. And the one who sent me, the one who called and commissioned me, told me that I would know when Jesus came. I saw him. And there he is. Right? And he proclaims him. So he said, he's coming. Here he is. See him. And then he finishes with follow. And that's the last piece. The piece that we didn't read this week, but next week, right? Or last week. That comes next week. Anyway. He says, follow him. Go after him. That is the one you want. He is the one that is worth knowing and loving. This call, this identity that was on John, was in submission to the Spirit of God. He was called, he was commissioned and equipped to make straight paths and to watch for Jesus. Right? That's every single believer's call. You are called to step into your world and to point people to Jesus. Now, the interesting thing is how he went about that. He was called to the wilderness, in camel hair, eating grasshoppers and honey, and baptizing specifically, not with the baptism of the Spirit, but with baptism of water. That was how his call expressed itself. And that was not everyone's call, right? That was a very unique call that he was uniquely equipped to accomplish. And he did so in a magnificent way that separated him from every other man. Think of this. He was the first prophet in 400 years. right? The first prophet in 400 years to show up on the scene and to express the coming of God. He had a very specific expression of that call, but ultimately the goal of that was similar and the same from every other person that sent him. And that is to use the gifting that you've been given to submit to the Spirit and to follow and say, there's Jesus. Know him. Follow him. Be part of his system. The other thing I wanted to point out here that I think is important is the way that he is so anxious to ensure that people are following Jesus first, right? So not only is his call to make the path straight and to be the one who points to Jesus, but he wants to make sure that they understand it's not about how you get to Christ through me, it's about Christ ultimately. And that humility that's expressed there is important, because if we miss that, it goes back to where I settled for a minute earlier on. I am not the Christ. You are not the Christ. But you are the signpost to Christ, right? And it's important to recognize the distinction there. And sometimes that's difficult for us because the line gets a little fuzzy if you're not careful. I am not here to be the Christ. I am here to point you to the Christ. But in that process, I become an expression of his glory. And then the other thing that I really think is fascinating about John the Baptist in particular is the fact, and this is something that you wouldn't know from John's account, but this is just in general. You know, what does John the Baptist end? You know, how does he end up? Dead, right. Thank you. Yeah. Dead. And it's interesting when you encounter that, actually, the story of his death in particular. Herod doesn't want to kill him. Herod actually tries to protect him. Think of that. Right? This ruler had come to respect this individual. This gnarly guy that hung out on the fringes of society. He respected it. He understood and tried to protect him, but ultimately he was unable to. And John the Baptist ends up dying for the sake of the truth, for the sake of another man's bad promises. But still, certainly, ultimately, John's end was pretty abrupt, almost as abrupt as his sort of beginning in terms of his ministry. The short space that he was called to, and then he was finished. But he was dedicated during that space of time to doing his job. And it wasn't always easy, right? There was at least one instance where we know that he sent, while he was in prison, he sent disciples and said, are you the one? I mean, this guy who says, I saw the Spirit descend on this one. I know him to be the one. And then he asks himself the question, but are you? That question will come. That question will come. Even in the midst of recognizing what is true and saying, I know you're Jesus. I know you're my Father and my Savior. I know you are who you claim to be. But are you? Are you really regularly going back through that process of believing and recentering on what you know is true? And what does Jesus do? He doesn't condemn John the Baptist. He doesn't say, how dare you question me, friend? You saw me and you saw the Spirit on me, and how dare you even think to question? Rather, he says, go and tell him what happened. Go tell him the things that I am doing, and reassure his heart, and it works. It's like, you are. Okay? You are the one. There is a season that comes in all of our hearts where, even in the midst of confidence, I know Jesus, I know my Father, I know my God, and yet there are times when I need others to come and remind me of what I know, and to tell me, look what God is doing. Don't forget what you know. Look what God is accomplishing. Don't forget what you know. Remember. Remind yourself to never forget. I'm trying to remember how that goes. There's somebody that has been sort of repeating that a lot. You know, this process of being human brings us regularly to places of doubt, and that's where you come back to what you know. And John the Baptist certainly does that. So John the Baptist, great guy. Super great guy. We barely just touched the surface even there, in all fairness. But what else do we need to make sure that we recognize? What is true here that we need to clue into just for a minute? Uh-huh. Right. Not what you would have anticipated at all, by any stretch of the imagination. Not what you would have expected the Messiah to be, the one who you've anticipated. Absolutely, that's good. And informative to us, because we have a tendency to look still for this Jesus that we've sort of painted in our heads. And when Jesus comes walking toward us, we're like, no, not you. That's not what I want out of my evil. How arrogant, how horrifying, frankly. But important to recognize. Who else? Right. 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 Mm-hmm. Not
and
him.
Where's the lion?
Right.
Like
right.
Lion, like the, you know,
right.
And
yeah. Absolutely. You know what it is? Yeah. That's huge. And again, the incongruence that we see so often with the expectation and the reality. And John, especially, you almost get this impression that like the difference between the two, and in fact, there's even the disciples sort of ask the challenging questions, like, why aren't you more like him, and why aren't you, like, they want to know, why are you guys so different? Because this difference is really unusual. John was sort of meant to almost, I think to some measure, he almost plays that role, which is like, this is what you think, this is what you would expect, and if he would have said, yes, I am Elijah, or yes, I am the prophet, or, they probably would have believed him, from what you can tell. I mean, it seems as if there were people that were pretty much ready to jump on board that wagon and say, this guy's the dude. Let's do it. But then the one unexpected comes, and he points all the glory on them and says, that's the one you're looking for. And that is a powerful sort of actual picture of the challenge that comes in faith often. Unexpected. Not what you anticipated. And it doesn't look like you thought it looked. Jesus is so much far beyond our meager expectations. And it's funny to think of a dude that's like living in the wilderness and being all tough to be meager in comparison to the glory of Christ. But that's the reality. Like, I'm not even worthy to unstrap his sandals. You don't get this. It's not like it's just like close. It's not even near close. Good. Very good. What else? I want to sing a song. We don't usually sing songs at the end, but today we're going to. So go ahead and stand with me, and we're going to sing with, I'm going to